Aho, and thank you for joining us here at Fonterra. I'm joined by our CFO, Mark Rivers. Many of you would have seen our 2019 results and media release this morning. Firstly, I'd like to start by acknowledging the frustration that our farmers and unit holders will rightfully feel and the impact that this performance and results have had on the share and unit prices and therefore on our owners' balance sheets. We don't take the decision lightly to impair assets and not pay a dividend. These decisions have been tough on the co-op, our shareholders and on our unit holders, and they are the right calls to reset our business and achieve success into our future. Which leads me to the first point on the summary slide. We had significant one-off adverse items totaling $885 million, resulting in a net loss for the year of $605 million. These adverse items reflect changing realities, such as the change in local economies, increased competition in markets, and challenges in some of our businesses that impacted expected forecast earnings from some assets. Mark will talk through these in more detail on the next slide. We've made good progress on our business reset. You'll see that in our financial discipline. We have significantly lowered our operating and capital expenditure, reduced debt, and improved cash flow. Specifically, free cash flow, the amount we have available to pay interest, dividends, and reduce debt, which increased from $600 million to slightly over $1 billion. It is also encouraging to see the business units that are the foundation of our new strategy, New Zealand Ingredients and our food service business, have improved on last year, with New Zealand Ingredients gross margin up 3% and food service gross margin up 10%. But we did have a number of challenges across the year, namely Australian Ingredients, our business in Latin America, and our consumer businesses in Sri Lanka, Hong Kong, and New Zealand. We need to lift our performance in these business areas. Despite the good progress on our financial discipline, earnings were not where they need to be, and this has resulted in an unacceptable return on capital of 5.8%. And finally, before I hand over to Mark, we had our third consecutive farmgate milk price over $6 at $6.35. per kilogram of milk solids, with milk collections marginally higher than the previous year. The current season is looking well positioned with our current range of $6.25 to $7.25 per kilogram of milk solids. I'll now hand over to Mark, who will provide further detail on the movements in net profit from F18 to F19.
Thank you, Miles. So the purpose of this next slide is to look separately at the change in the underlying performance and then the impact of the adverse one-off items. So please note the chart excludes minority interest, and so the NPAT is comparable with earnings per share. Firstly, looking at the underlying performance, the starting point on the left-hand side of the chart is the 2018 normalized profit of $382 million. We've taken into account the benefit received from the 5-cent adjustment to the milk price last year, as this is not expected to be part of ongoing operations. This is equivalent to $53 million on an after-tax basis. As mentioned earlier by Miles, our underlying operating earnings is not where we need it to be, down $60 million on an after-tax basis, resulting in an FY19 normalized NPAT of $269 million, which is equivalent to 17 cents per share. I'll discuss this on the next two slides in more detail when we look at each business. As we've discussed previously, we commenced a full review of the business following disappointing results in FY18. The review included an asset portfolio review, operational performance review, and strategic review. And this resulted in divestments of some assets, namely our Venezuelan consumer business, Tip Top, Foodspring, and we continue to progress the divestment of DFE Pharma and plan to sell our shares in Being Made. As we've announced, other assets are under strategic review, including DPA Brazil, our joint venture with Nestle in Brazil, and our two wholly owned China farms, farm hubs. That review process is underway, and we'll consider whether these assets are maintained or divested. We've also made some business restructuring decisions during the year, and as a result, we've changed the way that we account for our investment in Being Made, as we no longer have a significant influence. And this is a change from being classified as an equity accounted associate to a share investment. And we've made the decision to close our Dennington factory in Australia as a result of falling domestic milk production. As part of our annual review, we've assessed the carrying value of our assets based on forecasts of future earnings, and this has resulted in a number of impairments being recognized this year. The total of these adverse one-off items is a loss of $826 million, resulting in a reported net loss after tax attributable to equity holders of $557 million. The key amounts are impairment to Fonterra New Zealand of $210 million, impairment to China Farms of $203 million, impairment to DPA Brazil of $200 million, the disposal of the Venezuelan business, which is $134 million loss, resetting costs and impairment to Australian ingredients of $50 million, and a change in the accounting treatment of Beingmate, which results in a $12 million loss, and other strategic reset costs of $17 million. Now, while this is very disappointing, it is a necessary part of resetting our business for future success. Once taking into account the net loss attributable to minority interests, our total reported net loss after tax is $605 million. Additional details provided in the FY19 accounts, including the assumptions and sensitivities for the determination of updated carrying values. So moving forward to now looking at our underlying operating earnings, as mentioned, we were down on the previous year, and while we sold slightly more on a metric ton basis, our sales revenue was down 2% to $20.1 billion due to lower prices and our product mix, where we sold less butter, which is a higher dollar per metric ton product. The group normalized gross margin was down 4%, or $137 million. We had improved margin in New Zealand ingredients and food service, but this was more than offset by reduced margin from the challenges in Australia ingredients, Latin America, and some of our consumer markets. Operating expenses reduced by $185 million, or 7%, and this meant that we exceeded our target of bringing them back to FY17 levels within 2 years. However, we still have more work to do here, as the reduction did benefit from not paying performance bonuses in relation to FY19, and this contributed about $60 million. Despite operating expense savings more than offsetting the $137 million reduction in gross margin with a net improvement of just under $50 million, other income and equity accounted investments was down by $131 million, and therefore EBIT was down $83 million, or 9%. So in spite of the good progress we made on improving cash flow and reducing debt, given the disappointing earnings and significant one-off items, we made the decision to not pay a dividend this year. Just referring to the charts along the bottom of the slide, ingredients gross margin down 3%, EBIT down 8%. New Zealand ingredients performance improved on the prior year with gross margin up 3% due to higher volumes and favorable pricing. However, it was partially offset by bringing new plants online and peak volume costs. Australia ingredients gross margin was down 87% from $77 million to $10 million. Australia was impacted by higher milk prices in response to a competitive market, and our factories were underutilized due to lower collections. We closed Dennington to address overcapacity and undertook a business simplification process, and we expect future cost savings. Prolisur, our ingredients business in Chile, experienced strong competition for milk, and collections were down 16%, and gross margin was down over 140%. In summary, the total ingredients normalized gross margin was down 3%, and while ingredients reduction in operating expenses more than offset this, other income was down, resulting in normalized EBIT down 8%. Now, with regards to consumer and food service, gross margin was down 4%, and EBIT was down 14%. Overall, the consumer and food service business improved its performance in the second half relative to the first half, as both Greater China and Latin America recovered from slow starts, with 70% of consumer and food service earnings generated in the second half. Food service normalized gross margin was up 10%, and normalized EBIT increased 14%, mainly due to improved prices and product mix. Overall, consumer normalized gross margin was down 8% due to the challenges predominantly in Latin America, Sri Lanka, and Hong Kong. Oceania consumer and food service earnings increased 38% on improved performance in Australia and cost reductions in New Zealand. Overall, consumer and food service operating expenses decreased, but not enough to offset the lower gross margin and lower other income. So as a result, total consumer and food service normalized EBIT was down 14% on last year from $525 million to $450 million. China Farms, for our two wholly owned hubs, reduced operating expenses meant earnings improved from a $4 million loss to a $5 million gain. But at an EBIT level, we add in the profits and losses from milk sold by our ingredients, consumer and food service businesses, and the joint venture farm to provide an end-to-end perspective of the whole China Farms business. The ingredients loss has reduced, consumer and food service profit increased, but we did see increased losses in our joint venture operation. So the net result is our end-to-end loss reduced from $38 million to $30 million. So in summary, there are a number of areas of progress and also some disappointments driving our performance this year. Firstly, our financial discipline has seen significant improvements in both reduced capital expenditure and operating expenses. Food service gross margin across all regions improved. Greater China had growth in Anchor Food Professionals UHT milk and culinary cream. While Asia's increased gross margin reflected improved performance from Indonesia with increased focus on higher value products and having dropped the volume ambition. Latin America consumer gross margin was down due to a buy local marketing campaign in Chile impacting Soprole. However, it was good to see Soprole's performance returning to more normal earning levels in the last quarter. Asia consumer gross margin was down mainly due to pricing constraints in Sri Lanka, but progress has been made in this market as well. So at the start of the year, we set clear goals to focus on in order to take stock and get the basics right. In taking stock, we looked to reduce our leverage by reducing debt and gearing, and with significantly improved cash flows helped by divestments, we reduced debt by $469 million. Despite lower debt, our gearing ratio is similar to the prior year due to reduced equity from one-off items and impairments. But we're well on track to meet our reduced leverage target, and we'll provide more detail in the next slide on that. So with getting the basics right, we undertook to reduce our expenditure and live within our means. And here we've made very good progress on reducing capital expenditures, where we had a target of $200 million reduction in FY19. We actually exceeded that by reducing CapEx by $261 million. On operating expenses, our target was to reduce them by $160 million within 2 years, bringing them back to FY17 levels, and we actually reduced them by $185 million, although it did include the decision not to pay bonuses this year. So while we've made good progress, there's still more to do. Regarding more accurate forecasting, this is definitely a work in progress, and we have more work to do on that. There is inherent volatility in our industry and our business. However, we're committed to providing timely and realistic information. We're also committed to providing increased disclosure and transparency. Examples of such changes this year are the additional breakdown of overhead costs and quarterly earnings figures by business units. So just expanding on our commitment to reduce our financial leverage and strengthening the balance sheet, we have a clear plan and we've made good progress and we're confident that we can achieve the targets this financial year. This plan does include divestments and these can take time to get the best value for them, and that's our overriding objective. The credit rating agencies have supported our plan to deleverage. Remember, it's not just about divestments. It requires continued focus on financial discipline. And I'll cover off next year's operating and capital expenditure targets under our four-point plan for next year. Progress has been made in FY19, and I've already discussed the key drivers. Further progress is expected in FY20, when this debt will reduce by over $1 billion. We're already a significant way there, with the two divestment processes already announced that will settle in this financial year, these being Food Spring, where the sale has been completed, and DFE Pharma, where the sales process is underway. On their own, they'll contribute significantly to our debt reduction target. In addition to these announced investments, our target is to reduce debt by an additional $500 to $700 million, with the range reflected in our earnings range of 15 to 25 cents per share. It also includes reducing CapEx by another $100 million to $500 million and further divestments. So this results in our debt to earnings being back under the 4x target and on the way to our long-term target of 2.5 to 3.5 times. I've already covered the improved operating performance and the impact of not paying FY19 performance bonuses, so I'll just briefly explain some of the bigger movements within the business units. Within ingredients, the biggest reductions between FY18 and FY19 were sales and marketing expenses down $14 million, admin expenses down $28 million, mainly from cost savings from right-sizing Australian ingredients, including some one-off costs from closing Dennington, which were normalized. And within other expenses, FY18 incurred $20 million in relation to the Danone settlement. Consumer and food services biggest reductions between FY18 and FY19 were sales and marketing expenses down $33 million, mostly A&P. Spend distribution expenses down $13 million, which were mostly from reduced costs in Oceania. And we also committed to providing increased transparency on our unallocated costs, which is on the next slide, which goes into greater detail. So here on the next slide, you can see we've provided a breakdown of those unallocated costs into categories that we believe are appropriate at this time. So for illustrative purposes, we've assigned the 2019 unallocated costs to the business units where the primary function of the cost is to support those business units. The distribution is based on sales volume, and the balance is retained as not allocated. So some of the bigger movements, a $29 million one-off impairment of IT assets due to the change in business strategy. The majority of the reduction in farm services is because of reclassification of milk testing to the ingredients business. And $14 million reduction in advertising and promotion is a result of reducing our corporate brand advertising spend by about that amount. And within other, most of that is related to reductions in professional fees.
Great. Thanks, Mark. That brings us to our new strategy. And before I step through, I want to be straight with you about the starting point of our strategic review. And that's very much grounded in the fact that when you go through tough times, you ask yourself the hard questions. Before starting the strategy review, we took a hard look in the mirror and asked ourselves what we really want to be and what we've learned. 18 months ago, we might have said we're a global dairy giant, here to make the difference in the lives of 2 billion people. When times get tough, you reflect. We've been here nearly 150 years. We want to be here for at least 150 more. At the heart, we're a cooperative, doing amazing things with New Zealand Milk to enhance people's lives and create value for customers and our farmer owners. It may not sound so radical, but this simple change of how we think of ourselves really takes a different place and a stronger long-term future together. Our external context is complex and changing. Here you'll see the opportunities and growing risk we face. We're seeing consumer trends shifting, and this is driven by demographic changes, increased focus on health, and more people wanting to know where their food comes from and how it's produced. There are also some growing risks in the world that impact us, and we have to be very conscious of. These are things like the fact we have to operate in a volatile market, the increased trade tensions, and new foods that are disrupting the marketplace, changing regulations, and the focus on safe, sustainable produced food. Our co-op is well placed, but we have to face some hard realities. We have a number of strengths, including our people, scale, efficiency, which gives us optionality, and this means we can make choices over which markets and which products. We also have a deep, long customer relationships and impressive track record of innovation and R&D, and a great provenance story to tell our cooperative heritage, our New Zealandness, and our pasture-based farming system. But there are also some realities we face. Recently, we've underperformed and lost trust. Our impact on the environment is real, and improving it will raise costs and risk supply. Offshore corporate processes are coming and don't require share capital. We need to rebuild confidence that'll deliver on our commitments. We're a farmer co-op that needs to be here for generations, so we need to run a lower risk profile. So how are we going to make this happen? We know dairy demand is strong, and we're well placed to respond to changing consumer needs. A new strategy matches our strengths to consumer needs, focusing on the areas where we're uniquely placed to win in the market and create the most value for our co-op and our customers. It will take what's special about our cooperative heritage, our sustainable pasture-fed milk, to maximise sustainable value for our farmers, New Zealand Milk. We're going to make a real difference by focusing on 5 product consumption categories: core dairy, base and advanced ingredients, pediatrics, sports and active, food service, medical and ageing. We'll create new opportunities and new ways for food service. This will include diversifying our current focus on China and pushing more into Asia Pacific and other new markets. We'll still be in consumer and we'll focus on markets throughout Asia Pacific. The products we sell into these markets will be made from New Zealand Milk and be similar to those that we sell in our ingredients business. This creates efficiencies and helps us play to our strengths. We'll also reduce our consumer product portfolio to those that create superior value. So in short, how we describe the way we show up on the new strategy will be prioritising New Zealand Milk, grow our sales of sports and active, medical, ageing and paediatric ingredients, develop new food service markets, only make consumer products where we have a right to win, lift our research and development spend, use milk components and non-dairy ingredients sourced from around the world, collaborate more on intellectual property and skills, divest non-core business and reduce debt. To do this, we're going to prioritise 3 things. Innovation, where it creates value for our co-op and our customers. Sustainability, to do what's right and what's expected of us for the long term. and efficiency to create value from our unique scale and position in New Zealand. And we're going to do this in a purposeful way, bringing people together along with us on the journey. A lot of what is different about the strategy boils down to two changes in the way we think. The first is the focus on value. We've dropped our volume ambition early on in the piece. It's helped us cut costs dramatically and also helped us make better decisions day by day. When we talk about value, we mean value back to the co-op. For example, our sports nutrition ingredients are high margin and can deliver more value back than some of our consumer products that require significant investment into advertising and promotion. The second decision is that we don't have to be all things to all people. This is a New Zealand Dairy Farmers Cooperative, and we've been prioritising New Zealand milk. We've put in our research and development effort, energy and investment into these products in places where we know we can win. That means we'll be in less categories and we'll likely reduce our product portfolio drastically.
Yeah, so the last critical part of our strategy is the way we're going to measure success. We'll be measuring our success on a triple bottom line. So we're clear what we're trying to achieve: healthy people, healthy environment, and healthy business. You can't have one without the other two, so we need a strong co-op to deliver on all three. So for us to have a healthy business, we need to acknowledge that from a financial perspective, our strategy has two masters: a strong milk price and strong earnings. Both are equally important to us. Different parts of the strategy deliver value to one or both. So let's be clear, milk price doesn't just happen. There's a large group of people in the co-op that come to work every day to help deliver that price. And it's critical to ensure that we maintain our share of milk as international processors continue to compete for milk. Our market share keeps us internationally relevant to many of our largest customers. It also gives us options when it comes to deciding the product mix that'll deliver the most value in any given year. And alongside that, we know we need to deliver a return on your capital, which is precious, and to protect the value of your shareholding. We've set ourselves a set of targets to achieve in the medium term, the 2025, 2030, and we'll be measuring our progress against these. So first, for healthy people, we've got three targets. The first is that 100% of everyday advanced nutrition products must meet endorsed nutrition guidelines. Today, 71% meet those. We'll also continue to focus on health and safety and our zero harm philosophy. We want our total recordable injury frequency rate to be world class, and that's less than 5 per million work hours. Today, we're sitting at 4.9. And we also measure employee, farmer, customers, and public engagement and sentiment. For healthy environment, we're going to reduce manufacturing greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by 2030. In FY18, we'd reduced our greenhouse gas emissions by 3% on an FY15 base. We'll reduce water usage by 30% at sites in water-stressed regions by 2030, and we'll eliminate all solid waste to landfill by 2025. So for healthy business, it's about having a sustainable payout and return on capital along with reliable dividends. So this new strategy will result in improved financial performance and financial strength. And the metrics we're using to measure performance will emphasize cash flow and value creation. This slide summarizes key metrics from our 3- and 5-year plan and are based on our bottom-up budgeting and planning process. And one of the key outcomes will be growth in net earnings from earnings per share of 17 cents to 40 cents and then 50 cents. This will be driven by earnings growth from our core components of our strategy. That's ingredients for pediatrics, sports and active, and medical and aging categories. And growth from our food service business will also contribute as we will be developing new markets, especially China city expansion and into Asia Pacific. We'll still be in consumer, but we're going to focus on those markets where we have a right to win and where we can get a good return on capital. We'll build on FY19's strong financial discipline. We've set a target of capital expenditure not exceeding $500 million per annum as we continue to focus on getting the basics right. And we're going to earn the right to invest over and above that. Free cash flow will improve significantly over the 5 years, and we'll provide capacity to pay dividends and reduce debt. We'll reduce our leverage and target a debt to EBITDA ratio of 2.5 to 3.5 times. This is equivalent to a gearing ratio of below 40%. Our return on capital will lift due both to improved earnings and a lower capital base from divestments, which are expected to total $1.3 to $1.5 billion over the period of the 5-year plan. And this 3- and 5-year plan is based on getting the basics right. In addition, there are aspirational projects that add further value but are not included until we get the basics right and earn the right to undertake them.
Thanks, Mark. So in summary, what's going to be different? We'll be a leaner, more focused business, clearer about who we are, what we're going to do, and where we can win. I also want to be clear about what you can expect from us. Our culture is changing. We'll be open and honest about the challenges we'll inevitably face along the way. We're committed to delivering our triple bottom line, and our purpose and values will be at the heart of everything we do. F20 will be the first year delivering on our new strategy. We have four key priorities that will help take steps towards our goals of healthy people, healthy environment, and healthy business. They are: one, building a winning team. A big milestone for us here is introducing and successfully shifting to a new custom-led operating model. This will see us move from two large central businesses of ingredients and consumer food service to three in-market customer-facing sales and marketing business units that will bring the full strength of our cooperative to our customers. We're also creating a new team that enables our in-market business units to create value through innovation, sustainability, manufacturing, and supply chain scale and efficiency. And we'll reduce discretionary activities and overlap and responsibilities between our central support functions and the current ingredients and consumer food services business to help living within our means. A second priority is to support regional Zealand. And we'll do this by injecting $10 billion into rural communities through competitive milk price payments. As a cooperative, we have a duty to pay our farmers a competitive and sustainable milk price, and this brings significant value to regional New Zealand. The third priority is to reduce our environmental footprint. Through the cooperative difference, we'll work with our farmers, farmer owners, so that a further 1,000 farm environment plans have been rolled out in the new year. And we'll work to prepare emissions profile reports for all our farmer owners. And our manufacturing sites will continue to improve efficiency through energy and water efficiency at our manufacturing sites. Our fourth priority is to, of course, hit our financial targets. And those targets are improving our debt position so that our debt is no more than 3.75 our earnings, down from 4.3 last year. Reducing our capital expenditure to no more than $500 million, down a further $100 million on F19. And achieving a gross margin of excess of $3 billion and meeting our earnings guidance of 15 to 25 cents per share. This takes into account that we'll not have earnings from the business we have sold and are planning to sell, such as DFE. Before I take questions, Mark will provide some more detail on the F20 lookout.
Thank you, Miles. So the FY20 forecast overall has a similar milk price and collections to last year, but forecast earnings reflect the business reset and transition to the new strategy. Milk collections are in line, 1520 KGMS, and as expected, at this early stage of the season, we've got a fairly wide forecast milk price range of 625 to 725 with a midpoint of 675. Our earnings forecast of 15 to 25 cents per share for FY20 is built on a forecast EBIT range of 700 to 800 million, which is down on last year, but the midpoint of the EPS range is up, reflecting lower interest and tax. Within ingredients, we forecast our gross margin percent and our EBIT to be down on FY19, and the key changes between FY19 and FY20 are that we're assuming that we no longer have the DFE earnings. It includes a reduction in regulated return allowance for milk price due to lower assumed cost of capital as interest rates decline. And the forecast also does not assume the same level of favorable price relativities as last year. Within consumer and food service, we're expecting similar gross margin percentages but improved EBIT with a range of 430 to 530 million compared to 450 last year. This assumes that disappointing areas of performance last year do not repeat, that is, that Soprole returns to historical levels, as we saw in Q4, and we do not repeat the slow start to the year in China and Asia. And finally, our group operating expenses continue to be a key area of focus, and we expect further improvements there. So I think that's about sums up the position for us, Miles.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. If you wish to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press the pound or hash key. And your first question today comes from the line of Ari Decker from Jarden. Please ask your question, Ari.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I guess the first question I have is around the non-core businesses. I mean, you've outlined, you know, strategically where the focus is going to be, some comments away from consumer, you know, favouring New Zealand milk pools, et cetera. What does that mean, you know, because obviously you've done a lot of work over the last, you know, 12 months reviewing the assets. What does that mean for assets like Australian Ingredients, your interest in LATAM, Australian Consumer? You know, have you made decisions there that you're not sharing yet specifically, or is there still a process to go through with some of those sorts of assets which from the outside I guess look like they're non-core within the new strategy?
Yeah, hi, Ari, Miles Hurrell here. Let me first kick off by just saying that while not on strategy does not signal any intent around those businesses. I mean, where the strategic direction is heading and what we've outlined today is around where we will continue to focus and where that incremental dollar, I guess, will be spent to grow long-term value. It doesn't signal an end to those other businesses that may be outside of that. So, they need to stand on their own two feet and return value back to our shareholders regardless. I wouldn't read any further into it.
So decisions haven't been made on them. I mean, I guess if they have to stand on their own two feet and they're not where the, you know, because you've obviously outlined a pretty tight investment envelope, and a focus on the core businesses, I guess, how do you sort of satisfy yourself that those businesses won't kind of decline, you know, if they're outside of focus and think about, you know, maximising value from them, if they're not core?
Hey, Ari, it's Mark. It's a great point. Of course, in all of this, we're always going to be looking at the whole portfolio of our businesses, and each one again has to pull its own weight and needs to have the focus. There'll be clear ownership for each of the businesses and the like. Outside of what's been executed around investment, we've announced strategic review on Brazil and strategic review on China Farms. You can read into that, but that's obviously, you've got a range of choices when you do a review like that. And then you've got sort of the rest of the businesses, which when you lay what is core, what's non-core. But you look at like Australia, for example, which would fit somewhere, in the middle of that. There, you take that as the Australia Ingredients business as an example of where it's hit quite some headwinds with the drought. We have less milk going through the factories, so that's created an issue for us. You kind of look at that as a business, say, okay, what do we do? How do we improve that business, give it more focus? What kind of efficiencies and costs can we take out? And so hence the decision to take Dennington's out, all right? So overcapacity in the network, and we address that by the decision to shutter Dennington and look for other cost savings, things like that. So those businesses need to carry their own weight and get back to profitability. And we'll just take kind of that approach business by business.
Sure. Okay. On the capital structure, I presume a review sort of remains on the table there as you're progressing through the strategy side of things. Could you just, I guess, comment on the status of that and what the parameters of any review that's kicked off or might be kicking off is?
Yeah, I would say it's just getting underway, really. The first step was really to get clear on what is the strategy, which businesses do you want to focus on, what is the need of those businesses as we kind of make those choices, right? Which categories we're after, the organic growth opportunities, what are inorganic growth needs, what kind of CapEx and funding needs are those businesses going to need going down the road? And then we can start looking at structure. We've announced some work structure stuff from today, which we'll start being in the process of sorting through, but then capital structure follows right after that. So it's really just underway. In principle, the signals have been, we're prepared to look at everything. It's what structure do we need to bring this strategy now to life? So it's probably early days still, but in principle, all things are on the table.
Sure, and then just with regards to the dividend policy, and I may have missed it, but that dividend policy is obviously a reasonable departure from the past. Is there a commitment for that to hold true on that dividend policy regardless of what the milk price payout is?
Yeah, so this was an important part of the strategy discussion that we had with the board is just to look at the dividend policy and make sure it's still fit for purpose and sort of in line with, you know, part of the intent here is we're signaling is we want to have a conservative balance sheet, and obviously the reasons for that are A, to withstand volatility, which is always going to be part of the industry that we're in, but then the other is to give ourselves optionality to go after opportunities as we see them, and so that's sort of the, and we've signaled that in the 3-year and 5-year metrics there of what you expect that we're heading towards is kind of 2.5 to 3.5x debt to EBITDA. The way we've described, I think there's actually a slide which describes the new dividend policy that's deeper in the deck, which I think summarizes it pretty well. You know, 40 to 60% in principle of NPAT, excluding abnormal gains, and but then with some sort of caps around, taking a look at what kind of debt levels do we have, and we don't want to be in a position where we're paying dividends when we're outside of those sort of targets. At the end of the day, of course, it's always board discretion, and I'm sure in all those circumstances it'll be what is the circumstance we're in. If there's a period of investment needed, a CapEx, the good thing about that policy is it really puts the pressure back onto management and board to then justify, okay, we really believe in this investment and for these reasons, and just hold us accountable, I think, in a more straightforward way. That makes
sure.
Sense.
Yep. And then just the last question is sort of around the operating cost base of the business. There's some helpful disclosure there in terms of the breakdown of unallocated, and the like. I guess if I'm sort of to take what you've sort of said in response to my questions up front around the non-core businesses, you know, the fact that at this point it's China Farms and DFA that, you know, are subject to strategic review. Does that mean that, as it stands at the moment, and I accept your comments also about, you know, needing to be leaner and running each of the businesses better, but there's not anticipated to be, you know, any sort of major restructuring of the operating cost base of the business, you know, for, I guess, a more significantly shrunk down Fonterra? Would that be a fair comment at this point?
Ari Miles, I'm going to give you a view which is not, it won't answer your question, but I'll just give you at least a flavour. So we've announced today the new operating model which you referred to. That will then kick off a process internally to say what are the businesses need to support our strategy going forward. And I am on record already this morning with the media to say that will result in some changes to the size and scale of our business. We haven't yet landed on what that looks like, and we'll follow due process, but there are likely to be some changes through the next 3 months or thereabouts.
And will that largely be around sort of being more efficient, you know, looking at where there's potential to kind of, you know, group costs and those sorts of things, as opposed to, I guess, getting out of you know, shrinking it to, you know, because you're, you know, reducing the footprint that kind of exists today?
Yeah, so both. So if we're exiting the business, clearly that comes with the cost savings as well, but both, looking at the support structures that go to support our business into the future and what's required.
Sure. Thank you.
I think it'll be what we can try to do to make it clear is there'll be costs that disappear simply because we've divested and exited a business. And then there's sort of all the supporting structure that goes behind, which should allow us to get some efficiencies. But even above and beyond that, we're obviously wanting to continue to have more efficiencies and look for ways to improve.
I mean, Ari, in the video you've just listened to, you know, there was a real simple example, but it's the way we're looking at the business. You know, the Anlean specs or SKUs that we have, you know, 500 or 600 SKUs that currently exist, you know, heading towards a number closer to 50, you know, the cost and complexity to maintain those 600 is something that we shouldn't underestimate. So you think about if that's the lens by which you view your business going forward, along with the new operating model, we believe there is efficiencies to come. But we haven't landed on numbers at this point.
Great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Adrian Orban from Craigs. Please ask your question, Adrian.
Oh, good afternoon. I've got a couple of questions. Just maybe first one for you, Mark. Would you be able to bridge for us, if possible, just the key driver of how you've landed at sort of 17 cents of normalised EPS relative to, I guess, your 10 to 15 cent guidance?
Yep, sure. So I would, frankly, the biggest driver of landing outside is a decision. We announced the decision not to pay bonuses to staff for FY19. So that certainly had an impact there. That's probably the main driver. But beyond that, we've had a pretty good second half to the year, good Q4. Again, within the operations, quite encouraging to see Soprole come back to a good level of performance in Q4. And core ingredients, the core New Zealand ingredients business continuing to perform. Food service, gross margin up 10%, all of those elements. It was a good ending to the year for us, so we're very pleasing to see that.
Okay. And you mentioned those bonuses earlier. Were they of magnitude like 60 million? Was that the sort of number?
Yeah, that sort of scale impact on FY19 at the OPEX line.
Okay. And then if I just go to your, if I think about the ambition or the healthy business slide, which is 21, and I guess if you're looking at the 3 and 5 year plans, and particularly when you can you just give us a picture of what are the key things that drive that? Like, for example, like if you adjusted the FY19 down for the sale of, say, DFE in Tip Top, you'd be probably 80 million of EBIT shorter than what you've described there. So it's actually quite a steep lift. Is the further divestments, are they cutting out loss-making businesses? And what's the other two or three kind of key things that need to go right on that three-year plan?
Yeah, so first, I think just to say, is in that three-year, five-year plan, we've been careful to have that reflect in principle only the announced sort of divestments. And so obviously over that period of time, as we make decisions along the way, you might see, different impacts here or there. But this, I think directionally this gives you a good sense of it, so, which means that where that growth is going to come from is, from a few different areas. One is, we've got the organic growth opportunity with food service and with the functional nutrition units. So in the 3 year plan, the biggest impact is making progress on food service, which continues to be on a good trend. So and that's within both the China market as we spread into lower tiered cities. There's still a significant opportunity in Southeast Asia and Asia for food service. And so it's continuing to do that. Second part of the puzzle is in that near term is efficiencies on the OPEX side. So as we make some of those scoping decisions, but narrower focus, leaner go-to-market models across the different business areas, the benefits of examples like Miles had mentioned around simplifying our portfolio and the number of SKUs that we have in the different parts of the businesses, those benefits will start to come through. And then, of course, on the CapEx side and on all those that we've got a lot of investments that we've made already in plant capacity. And so the strategy will help us to fill those plants over the coming years, and we'll start to see the benefits of that come through. So that's really the primary drivers. One other piece, of course, down to NPAT level is as debt levels come down, then interest expense will come down. So that's a pretty significant driver in the way we've modeled it here.
And just to come back to the asset sales side of it, sorry, I get the other pieces, but just if we're calibrating from start, like if you said the FY19 actual, am I right in saying that like if you rolled that forward to today, the base would be kind of more like 750 if you took out DfE and Tip Top, because clearly those two assets are probably sitting in that FY19 number.
Yeah, something on that scale I think would be fair enough to say. Think of it that way, yeah.
Okay. And then if you roll forward to the three-year plan, of the stuff that you've sort of, like the DPA, Brazil, and the China farms, if you sold those, would that, are they, how much in aggregate would they be contributing, or are they actually loss-making in total?
Well, you can see, yeah, so China farms, you can see spelled out pretty clearly in that way. We've got an end-to-end view, which is a loss currently.
Yep.
Obviously, over time, we would expect that to improve. Yeah, I would say that's still a pretty good base. Brazil, you've got some. I guess we've got a certain amount of disclosure there on Brazil, but yeah, those would not be very large contributors to EBIT at the moment. I guess the other dynamic in there, as you go from 19 and it's embedded in our 20 outlook and beyond, is 19 is certainly hit with things like Australia drought and with a pretty weak consumer performance in Latin America, especially Soprole. And so we certainly assume a normalization on those effects. So that probably accounts for another part of the gap there, the improvement that we've projected.
Okay, thank you. And then maybe just like a question for Miles, like when I look at slide 10, which is sort of entitled "We've Made Some Big Choices," and if you go four down, where you're going from dairy only to supplement with non-dairy, what is the supplement with non-dairy? Can you just give us an example or some sort of lens that you're looking through there?
Yeah, so we have been using non-dairy for probably at least a decade in some cases. There is a milk powder with vegetable oils that we've been sending into Africa for quite some time to target a different price point consumer. So that's an example that already is there. We're just, I guess, bringing it out to suggest that if this is where consumers are starting to head, and some consumers are starting to think around non-bovine milks and other opportunities to bring both bovine and non-bovine dairy and plant-based together, there are potential opportunities out there. This is not a signal for our farmers to change their farming systems, because the growth of bovine milks in the global context is still very strong, and we see that continuing into the future. This is just signalling, as we get close to customers, get close to consumers, and understand their needs, we need to be flexible around choice.
Okay. And then just final question for me: if I look at the farm gate milk price statement, and then can you just give us a bit more detail around what's driving up the 10 cent lift in cash costs? I can see the table sort of split between cost, price, structural, and one-off.
Yeah, so, I guess a couple of things impacted. So one is this season you have some higher conversion costs, which are driven by things like energy costs were higher, and we also this season we had quite a large peak milk season, so we were had some costs bringing milk across the straits and things. The other part of the milk price construct is every 4 years there's the overhead cost reset, and so that was done this year, and so that led to some more costs being folded into the milk price this year, and we'll see that in FY20 as well. But those are the main drivers of that.
And just on the FY20, is there further to go into the milk price in FY20, or are you just saying the step up in the 19 remains into FY20?
Yeah. Well, a little bit of both on the overhead cost side of it, but there are some other countervailing pieces. So we expect that to be fairly level 20 versus 19.
Okay, thank you for that.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is star one to ask a question today. And your next question comes from Nick Ma from Macquarie. Please ask your question, Nick.
Hey guys, just on the dividend, are you guys intending to apply that policy for the FY20 year?
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's cool. And then in terms of, you know, those five key categories, can you just talk through what you haven't been doing in those categories right to date, which gives you confidence that you can actually capitalize on them from here forward and drive the improved earnings you're looking for?
Well, I mean, probably the other way, maybe the other way to ask the question or how I respond to it is probably we kicked off our sports and active, our healthy aging medical nutrition units within the last 12 months and have seen some great signs of life in those areas. We have a range of innovation and technologies that have been developed over a number of years that suit these categories quite well. So we have already kicked these businesses off, and which that gives us confidence as opposed to new businesses or haven't performed, which gives us the confidence, which is, I think, the way you asked the question. So what you're seeing here, I guess, in the entire strategy here is the businesses that have actually shown to perform previously is where our focus is going to be, and we're going to double down and increase our spend in R&D on those areas because we've shown that we've got a competitive advantage and a right to win.
Yeah, that's cool. And then just on the
food service, just expand on that, you know, as a case in point, you know, from nothing 5-odd years ago to a very successful business, and again this year, a 10% increase in gross margin year on year. So, again, more focus on food service in the years ahead and expanding beyond quite a heavy reliance on China at this point.
We're very deliberate in the strategy and the review is looking at, you know, where are those growth opportunities, where are the trends that are going, and matching that up against where do we have advantages that we think we can play, and certainly that Palmerston North, you know, R&D center has already played a key role and will continue to play a key role for us to be able to capitalize on that.
Yep, and then just on the CapEx, within that 500, do you just assume further reductions in growth CapEx and stay in business is roughly the same, or are there further savings to come from your general kind of maintenance bills per annum?
No, we're comfortable with, I guess, our, call it essential capital around the rate of depreciation. So we're comfortable around that level of circa 400. So while the 600 down to 500 that we're signalling this year would suggest a further reduction in growth, growth capital, remember there was quite a hefty carryover from F18 into F19. We've ended F19 in a pretty tidy state, and so not many projects are left with still capital to spend. So we're still continuing to focus on growth parts of our business, aligned again to our strategy. And while, you know, today is the official launch, if you like, I mean, we've been heading in this direction as a business for a number of months now. So any capital projects that have been coming across the table that haven't been aligned to where we were likely to head haven't been given much airtime.
Yeah, great. Thanks a lot.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is star one to ask a question. And your next question comes from Marcus Curley from UBS. Please ask your question, Marcus.
Good morning, afternoon, guys. A couple from me. Just following up on the CapEx answer. So if you've got a circa $100 million worth of growth CapEx, you know, is that really enough to meet the aspirations of transforming this business over the next 5 years?
Yes. We are very confident of that. Partly on the back of some quite significant investments in the last 3 to 4 years, if I'm honest, which play to our food service story. So we have capacity that's been built here in New Zealand at Darfield and Clandeboy, which are well aligned to continue for growth. When you get into the sports and active lifestyles, healthy aging, pediatrics, medical nutrition, those, you know, they're not capital plays. They are OPEX plays, if you like, and using the strength of our R&D pipeline. So we're very confident in the 500 put forward that is more than enough to cater for the current plans. But we're also very clear that if opportunities arise that are aligned to our strategy, we'll have a think about those, but we're also cognizant we need to earn that right. And so what you're seeing here in our plans for that 3-year horizon, at least, is a signal that we need to earn the right to go and spend capital on that next wave of investment.
Okay. I got to add one more point. That's Marcus. That's to see in the strategy is we want to sort of experiment with and find ways to partner without in a capital light sort of way. So it's kind of a little bit different mindset. In the past, we might have brought our checkbook to go and do a partnership and contribute, sort of buy into partnerships with large amounts of CapEx. The reality is we've got a lot of know-how and expertise, and so we want to see how do we monetize that? How do we take advantage and use kind of an IP play to enter a partnership, which is actually what many partners are looking for from us. That can be our contribution into an arrangement.
Okay. Just on the dividend policy, could you provide some color on the debt metrics that need to be met? And secondly, when I look at the debt guidance for FY20, it doesn't look to me like you're assuming you're going to pay a dividend in FY20. Two questions on that front.
Yeah. So I guess for the debt metrics, sort of point that we're wanting to maintain that A-band credit rating. And in order to maintain that, and Simon, you can comment more in your discussions with the agencies as well, to be well within the band, so we want to be below 3.75 and below would be the sweet spot to get down to debt to EBITDA. And then as we implement the strategy, we've laid out the targets to get down to the range of 2.5 to 3.5x over time, we're comfortable able to do that through the combination of all of those things that we've talked about, right? The greater focus, selective divestments of non-core stuff. In FY20, the targets are kind of with all that in mind, and over that period, being in a position to be able to implement that dividend policy, even in FY20, obviously subject to those are final board decisions, and I'm sure it'll be the circumstance of where we find ourselves at that time. But that's the intent, and that's what's modeled.
And sorry, the second question was, if I look at the slide with the debt guidance on it.
Yep.
It doesn't look to me like a dividend is assumed, and I suppose, is that the right assumption in the forecast as it stands on slide 8?
So Simon here. The range that you've got there is for the 15% to 25% EPS range. So, Marcus, at the lower end of that earnings range, then you're correct. You'd be at the upper end of that. But in the cash flows that we've modelled, we have, as Mark said, we've actually included that provision in there. We have to make the earnings first, but it wouldn't be on top of this. So, I guess the way to look at it is if we meet our earnings range, then and achieve the other assumptions in there, then that capacity is already included in that cash flow.
Okay, so you're not at this stage, you're not ruling out paying a dividend in FY20.
Absolutely not. No, in fact, the opposite. The intent is to be in a position to be able to do that.
Yeah. By meeting our basically the guidance and those key drivers, and for example the lower CapEx that Mark and Miles have both talked about, that assumes the 500 million. We expect to be that's the case, and if we that earnings range, then you would have that capacity to do it.
Where there can be some conceptual discussions will be around, as you go down divestment path, is how to handle that from a dividend perspective, but the intention here with hitting these targets is to put ourselves in a position that we pay, and that's what's modeled.
Is a change to the milk price structure off the table, or has that been reviewed?
Well, I guess whenever you're looking at, we've said capital structure is on the table for us to look at to ensure that that's fit for purpose with the strategy. And so in a co-op, obviously, whenever you think of capital structure, you have to look at milk price. So in principle, all of that's being is fair game to look at. Again, it's about is it fit for purpose given the circumstances of where we're at. You've got kind of a flatter milk pool in New Zealand. You're competing for milk. All of these elements, what the CapEx needs are for the co-op going forward. There's so many elements to take into consideration, but But having a milk price regime, which we have, which is in, you know, the intent behind it is somehow reflect what the commodity value of milk is going to be important in lots of different scenarios, I can imagine. So I think that will continue, and having a entry and exit, and having a share standard and all those elements, you start to get into a theoretical discussion and all those things, but in principle, all of those mechanisms have to make sense altogether.
Okay, and then just on the result itself, can you just provide a little bit more perspective on why the non-reference product gross profit fell by 11%? Because when I read the document, you talk about better pricing, positive stream returns. Yeah, by the look of things on a like-for-like basis, volumes were relatively flat for non-reference. So, yeah, I struggle to understand why the profitability was down 11.
Do you guys have some details?
Yeah. So you're looking at the slide in the appendix there, Marcus?
Well, either that or in the report. So non-reference products gross profit 768. Wrong one. 701 versus 791 the previous year.
Yeah. So essentially, it's largely driven at the cost line. So the comment there about it's the increased cost of the protein that goes into the allocation of the milk price that gets put against the non-reference. So you've obviously made the adjustment just for the volume metric there that goes through. So that has an impact. So if you look at the footnote there, there's as part of it, but it's essentially at the cost line that's impacting. Correct. So that as per the point above, and as Mark said, there was a slight decline in the fat prices, so that's slightly favourable on the reference, and then increased cost of protein on the non-reference.
And then just as you flow into your guidance in FY20 and ingredients, can you actually call out what the DFE impact is in terms of the lost profitability?
What was that? I couldn't hear that.
DFE.
Oh, DFE. So for DFE at the, at the EBIT level, it's around 40 million impact.
And is that a full year? Is that mostly gone for the full year?
That's full year.
And then you also mentioned you don't expect pricing to be as good. Can you give a bit of color on that point?
Are you talking specifically DFE now, or are you talking more broadly? Sorry.
No. Within the ingredients drop in profitability.
Oh, in the ingredients. Okay, yeah. So what, I guess there, what's meant there is just that from when we're looking out in the forward year, it's always hard to forecast out what kind of stream returns we can expect, and so we just assume a slightly positive stream returns in our bottoms up, knowing that there's things that can move around.
Okay.
So I think we assume about 50 million positive stream returns is built into our bottoms up, which is a slight decline on where we've landed for 19. But,
and what was 19? Sorry.
We had more favorable stream returns within 19.
Yes, can you provide the number?
I don't think we've got it broken out, do we, Simon?
The delta, though, just in terms of to give you a sense of that budget, is the what Mark's really covered there as a base case. So in broad terms, if you take, say, 40 to 50 off from DFE, 50 less on streams because we go for a more neutral budget, and then the milk price whack has a negative impact as well of around 50.
And finally, sorry for a number of questions, but I was interested to see that you haven't appointed a China CEO. Obviously, it's one of the three major roles. I would have thought there would have been someone in the business. I can think of a couple maybe that would be good candidates for that. Is yeah, are those people leaving, or are you just looking to do a broader search, unhappy with their performance? Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that role?
So, Marcus, I, like you, I also see a couple of good candidates for the role. So we've got a head of ingredients business that resides in China now, reporting to Kelvin, and we had a head of consumer food service, Christina Zhu, reporting to Judith. So both of those two will be up for discussion around heading up the entire China business, and I'll go through that process relatively quickly. But they're both still in the business today, I might add.
Okay, thank you.
There are no further questions at this time. I will now hand back to Miles for any closing remarks.
Thank you very much for taking the time, everyone, today. Of course, this is not the end of any responses from us, so feel free to reach out to any of the team if you have any further questions over the coming days. But again, thank you for your support, and look forward to meeting you all again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.